Accession number 28699, Reel 5.
Mr. Casey, Reel 5. So after a period of time with the tanks, you've got this move to the infantry. Why do you think that was brought about?
Well, we were informed that they'd lost many more casualties in the infantry in the desert than they'd anticipated, and not as many tank casualties. And so every officer under 30 in our brigade was transferred to the infantry. Well, we were all horrified at the idea. In fact, I joined the tanks, volunteered for the tanks, so as not to go in the infantry. Anyway, they sent us on a 6 weeks course to Dunbar. And in their wisdom, they reckoned in 6 weeks you could be trained as an infantry officer. It was a very bolshy place, because we had captains on the course, and senior lieutenants, you know, who were all objected very strongly to being transferred. But there was a childish, bolshy atmosphere there. People did ridiculous, childish things, like pouring water under doors in bedrooms and all kinds of silly things. And never cooperated with the lecturers. I mean, whenever one of the infantry lecturers said, what do you suggest we should do in this attack? And they always said, well, you send a squadron of tanks. And he said, no, we haven't got any tanks. And that was the first solution to everything. And trouble was, we were marched around like we were all other ranks, you see. And had to salute majors and things, and we felt we were being treated not like officers, you see. So they behaved not like officers, they behaved like children, some of them. And then you had others who were quite witty and clever. One chap who was a barrister in ordinary life wrote various poems about the place, and I can only remember one little bit about when you're weary of harakiri and the Japanese you're routing, you'll fight in trees on a flying trapeze, according to Captain Houghton. You know, so all these kind of daft things. And then three of them, I think, ran round one night firing blanks in the rifles, you see. So they were up before the colonel, and this barrister fella, the colonel said to him, you could have injured somebody seriously. He said, no, not really, sir. You see, we're not allowed to have live ammunition. We haven't got to that stage yet of being felt capable of handling live ammunition, you know. And he said, look, when you went out with those rifles, who were you trying to shoot? And he said, no one in particular, sir, just opportunity targets, which is a military phrase. So he sent the other two out and concentrated on this one, and that really tore him off a strip. So there was that kind of atmosphere. I suppose we did actually do some training, because we realised we were going to have to do it, you know. But my best friend at the time joined the army with me as a recruit, and we met up at Dunbar. She was in the tanks somewhere else, and we met up at Dunbar on this course. And at the end of the course, you had a choice of where you wanted to go. You could suggest. So he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to the Dermalite Infantry. This is my own place, you see. Now, he was from the south, but he said, oh, I'll come as well. So we both went to the Derms, and he never took to it at all when we were training. He said, I know I can't do it. And he was a brilliant tank fella. And he said, I just hope I don't get my platoon killed. Anyway, when we did the Longjerv attack, the night before, he was sitting outside his slit trench and they got a direct hit. So he was killed.
What was his name?
Donald Laycock. And I felt so guilty because he'd come with me to the drums and he would have been somewhere else, you know. So I felt so guilty that and very angry that he'd been transferred.
It must have been pretty tough for you all. I mean, you'd be working with tanks as entirely different
world. Oh, yes.
And presumably you went through the usual infantry drills.
Yes.
As you say, as if you were just recruits.
That's right. And when I arrived at the Durhams, the 9th ALI, they'd been training for some weeks, marching every Saturday. And they'd now got to the stage where they were going to do 20 miles in full kit. I'd never walked anywhere. And I arrive on the Friday night, and on Saturday morning, I'm taking my platoon on a 20-mile route march in full gear. Well, when I got back, my blisters had blisters, you know. And the last 2 miles, the two fellas with the Piat, that was a little anti-tank gun, and it had bombs, we called them, Piat bombs, that fitted on it, six Piat bombs, were quite heavy. So they packed up and they were put in a truck. So the sergeant carried the Piat gun and I carried the Piat bombs for the last 2 miles. I don't know how, but I did. And when I got there, I mean, the first thing you had to do was inspect the men's feet to see that they hadn't got the beginnings of foot rot or anything. And then I took my own off and my feet were bleeding. I thought, what am I doing here in the infantry, you know?
Is it a tradition in the infantry that the officer must see to his men before he sees them?
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. And there was a very clever thing that Montgomery did. In the First World War, apparently, there were tremendous numbers of trench foot, which made you incapable of operating. And he brought in a law, really, Montgomery law, that any man with trench foot, his officer's leave would be stopped. And you never had a case. Because when you inspect the feet, you'd see the beginning. You see like a bit of athlete foot. And that was treated before it could get worse. And that was one of his most brilliant commands, I think. I never heard of anybody with trench feet in our war.
How long was the course at Dunbar when you...
6 weeks.
So yeah, it was pretty tough, pretty cramming a great deal in 6 weeks.
Yes, it was. I mean, we did actually do a lot of work, but there was a lot of messing about as well.
Presumably you'd have to learn about infantry weapons.
Absolutely, everything. We had to do the whole thing of, first of all, the weapons, secondly, the tactics, then all about how you, you know, looked after your men and so on. So it was an intensive course.
Were there any particular tactics that you had to learn when you mentioned, you say tactics?
Well, I can't think of any particular tactics, but I mean, you learned how to operate as an infantry platoon, really. You know, how to dig a slit trench, how to keep down when you had to, and how to do whatever infantry soldiers had to do. And the main thing was impressed upon you that you were responsible for 30 men and their lives and everything depended on you and their welfare, you know. So there was much more intense training about that side than there was in the tanks. And as I say, the first day, you know, I arrived, the next morning I'm doing a route march.
Where was the battalion when you joined them?
Oh God, no. I'm just trying to remember. I think we were... It was just before we went to Portsmouth. To Southampton, was it? Where were we?
I think they were in East Anglia, that area at one time.
Yes.
And then they moved down to...
Southampton.
To the forest, to the wood, when they were kind of wired in almost prior
yeah.
to going.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you remember those times?
Oh, yes, I remember being kept in. And So it was probably, as you say, East Anglia. I remember being near a beach because we had to do a 2 mile march up in the sand, which was far worse than the 20 miles on the roads. Full kit, 2 miles in the sand was incredibly difficult. And then, as I say, we were...
Do you recall any major exercises that you took part in this pre-D-Day training?
No, nothing. Nothing stands out at all. I mean...
Was any training with tanks again?
No.
With D-Day looming?
No.
Actually, I would have thought in that situation you would have had some knowledge that most infantry officers didn't have.
Ah, yes. Could have had. In fact, I did once go into action... Well, sort of into action. There was a troop of tanks that came up to support us at one place, and they had to be shown where to go, how to get into the attack, really. So the colonel said, you're an ex-tank man, Jim, you go and show them, tell them where to go. So I got in, climbed under the tank, the officer's tank, and got inside, and I sort of led the tank troop as how to get there. And I was quite thrilled. I thought, well, I have actually got into action in the tank after 2 years of being in the tank. But we didn't train with them particularly. And in fact, you see, I think by the time I got there, nearly all the training had been done.
It must have been very close to the...
Yes. Oh, yes. It was only, I think, in a very, very short time, we were wired in. Was it in Portsmouth? I forget now.
It was a wooded area outside Southampton.
Southampton, that's right. Yeah. Because the thing that's very vivid, when we were in Southampton, we weren't allowed out. My father came up on the train with his two stooges to Southampton. Now, when people came into Southampton, they were quizzed by the police, you know, what you're doing here. So he told them he was coming to do troop shows. And... anyway, he got down near and rang up the place and said, "Oh, my name is Jimmy James, a comedian, who we pretty well known then." And he said, "I've come to do a show for the 9th Dunlight Infantry. Could you put me through to the entertainments officer, Mr. James Casey?" So I get this phone call. I said, "Hello." He said, "It's Dad." I said, "Bloody hell, what are you doing? Where are you?" He said, "Just outside." I said, "Oh." He said, "You're the entertainment officer, aren't you?" I said, "Of course I am, yes." "Well," he said, "we'll have to discuss this show. So I'll meet you outside." So I was allowed to go out to meet this comedian who was going to do a show for us. So I went and had tea with my father and his two stooges when nobody was allowed out. But that was typical of my father. If you said you can't do it, he did it.
And this is a northern battalion, and presumably your father would be more well known to them than...
That's right, yes. Yes.
And did they know that your father was Jimmy Jewell?
Jimmy James. Well, yes, one or two of them would know. Officers, probably. And I probably talked about it anyway to any of the fellas who asked about it. I mean, it was never a big thing. But I'm sure a few of them knew. But certainly this, whoever was the officer, the adjutant who spoke to, or whatever, I don't know, had heard of him, obviously. And then he put him through to me and the Durhams. The entertainment officer.
But you weren't the entertainment
officer. No, there was no such thing.
You were, as it were, wired in, and no one was allowed out, were they, at this point in time, with D-Day looming. What activities were going on in there? You must be really preparing yourself for this landing.
Well, we were, yes, but also there's a lot of leisure things to keep everybody occupied and contented. I mean, I don't think it was a great deal as far as the men were concerned. We used to have order groups and things and showing us the layout of where we were going to land and so on.
The kind of models?
Models, yes. Yeah. But the men really got very little. They knew they were going over. That's about it. And then, on the night before the day, June the 5th, we were put on the ships, landing ship infantry I was on, which was tiny thing, commanded by an American ensign, which is like midshipman.
Just before we move to an interesting point, 9 July, as with the whole of 15 divisions, had been fighting all over the place.
Yeah.
Now they were going to have to go in first again after returning to England, thinking they were going to be a follow-up division.
That's right.
Was that attitude, you know, was there a moan about that, a groaning?
Well, there was, amongst the ones who'd been in the desert and so on, you see. I mean, my platoon, about 70% of them had been in the desert. And here was I, a rookie, you know, in charge.
That must have been difficult, I would have thought.
Well, it was, but I cut through a lot of rubbish, which the army used to do. For instance, every week you had to have an ABCA lecture, I think it's an education thing. Now, these were the most boring things you've ever known in your life. It would be discussing, I don't know, India or some remote legislation or something. So I thought, well, this is rubbish. Everybody's bored stiff. I'm not having that. So the very first one, I said, the lecture today we have to discuss is so-and-so. And I said, which I think is a load of rubbish. Yeah, so do we, sir. I said, so I thought we would discuss something that might affect us all. Should brothels be legalised? Well, after an hour, I said, I'm sorry, we've got to pack up now, the hour's up, you see. And so I always had a topic like that, that everybody had opinions about. Once I had one about anti-Jewish thing. And I had a Jewish lad there, and I said, Have you found any antagonism, any racism against you? He said, yeah. I said, go on, tell us. And we had this discussion about anti-Semitism. So, you know, they got to think I was, a reasonable bloke who they could talk to about things. And, you know, I had them coming to me about problems at home. I mean, I was 21, 22, and they're starting to sort out the marriage problems, you know. But I did build up this kind of rapport with my platoon, and which we kept. And I realised that these lads who'd been in the desert, people thought, oh, veterans, you know, it's great. Well, it wasn't, actually. I mean, they might know what to do, but they weren't that keen. If you had a platoon of new recruits, they'd go anywhere and do anything. You say, attack that, and they'd go. These lads just think, wait a minute, is that a good idea? You know. So you had to be sensible with them, and you had to lead. As I said to this fella on the course, if you don't go first, they're not going to come. And your sergeant is at the back, making sure they come. I remember doing one attack, which was a lousy situation because we'd gone behind the German lines and cut across. So there was nobody for us to shoot at. And it was a beautiful sunny day. And we were being fired at from either side on the hills by mortars and tanks. So it was a lousy situation. And there's one lad, and he was lying down. And I went back and I said, what's the matter? Where you hit? He said, I'm not hit. That's cutting your bloody feet then. Now, you keep going or I'll shoot you. Which that was ridiculous, but he came with me all the way. And when we got onto the objective, when he got onto the objective, he was jumping around full of beans. Ah, we did it, we did it, you know. And he was great after that. But we'd had quite a lot of casualties on the way, and at the time you kind of ignore that. There's this feeling of euphoria that you've made it, and then you suddenly remember the lads who haven't. And one there, when we arrived and he was jumping around, there was another lad there with a stomach wound, you know, and saying you mustn't give him any water, and then get the morphine thing and inject him. But for the moment, you had this feeling of elation. So that it's a very weird situation. But I remember that lad vividly. I don't remember his name, but I remember vividly that he went all the way, and he was great after that. Nothing worried him.
Can we come back to the early days you were with them? Was there any problems with absence without leave?
Very little. Very little.
I think prior to that there had been when they first came back from the...
Yes, but I never had any in my platoon, and I don't remember any in the company.
Do you remember any of the names of that first platoon that you had in the...
Not
Nightingale
really.
Forest, that's the place I'm trying to think of, in Southampton.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not really. I mean, Sergeant Cameron and Sergeant Willis, Corporal, I remember... there was a corporal who was a Cockney. I don't know how he was in the Germans, but he's a broad Cockney, and his mother was French and his father was English, and he was called Pierre Jordan. And I could never forget him, because he took the mickey out of me. I mean, on that attack that I mentioned, I was in front and sections were coming through, and the sergeant at the back, platoon sergeant at the back. And his section, he was a section leader, and he came through with one man. And I didn't notice at first that he had the Bren gun and two something else he was carrying the lot, you see. And I turned around and gave him a right rollicking, you know. You couldn't push a bloody pram, you saw that. And he hasn't got a tin hat on, he's got his berry on the back of his head. And I've never forgotten. I stood there in the midst of all this, falling about laughing. And his black humour, you see, which we had in the war, he said, "What's the matter with you up there? Are you getting scared on your own? This is all I've got left. All the other buggers are dead. What do you want me to do, resurrect them?" Well, I stood there laughing my head off. Unfortunately, they hadn't all been killed. But that was the humour there, you know.
Do you remember where this was, this particular incident you're describing?
Well, it was in Normandy. It wasn't long after Longeuve, so it was like towards the end of June, I think. And we'd gone through and then turned behind the German line, so we were in the middle of them. I can't remember where it was, but it was a beautiful sunny day, and, you know, we were just being shot at, and there was nobody for us to shoot at, which is worse.
Can we come back now to the actual invasion itself?
Yeah.
We will be coming into the actions, obviously, when you made the crossing.
Well, going over...
There must have been, I'm thinking, on this side of it. Did you see much of the Americans and that in the area of, you know, Hampton?
No. We didn't see anybody, really, for the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks that we...
What was the company you were allocated to?
D Company. And...
Who was commanding, do you remember?
Yes, I'll never forget Major Rumble, who I will mention frequently, not to his advantage. Anyway, so we finally went down to the docks, and we went on this boat, which was tiny, landing ship infantry. And eventually we set off that night. And I've never been so seasick. Well, I've never been seasick like that. It was just terrible. And we got... When we arrived, we started to get dressed. So I got up, put my socks on and shirt, and went and threw up. And I put my trousers on, and I was sick again. And eventually, I went up on the deck, fully dressed, with a Mae West round and this enormous waterproof which came under my armpits, which is around other people's waists. And I lay on the deck in the spray, still being seasick, and this American ensign said, "Oh hell, we're going to the wrong beach, we've got to do a turn." So we did a quick turn round to go to the other part of the beach. And I remember shouting to him, "Look, just put me off. I don't care if the German army is waiting for me. Let me die on land. I've never known anything as bad in my life.
A pretty rough crossing.
Oh, terrible. And the amazing thing was, once you landed, and we jumped out, and it was about, I suppose, 3 feet of water, something like that, and the seasickness went, instantly. And I can remember my batman at the time, he went under, and I grabbed him and pulled him up, and we landed an hour after the first wave. So we didn't actually have any casualties on the beach at all. I think we had one, not in my platoon, but there was one. I think it was an officer, I don't know. Somebody went down and didn't come up again.
No, it was a sergeant.
Sergeant, well.
Yes. And with, who was then Major Moggs' landing craft, who was on the same landing.
Ah, well, anyway. So we went up the beach, no problems. And we started walking up the road. So we're kind of leading the war now, you know. Well, I am trying to get these waterproofs off, and I can't rip them. And so I halted the platoon, put in the ditches, and I started stripping off my equipment, see, and the sergeant came running up and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to get these bloody waterproofs off. He said, well, there's a thing there, you pull it. I said, now you tell me. He said, well, I told all the men. I said, no, you didn't tell me. He said, I thought you knew. I said, no. So I put my gear back on.
So, Mr. McCormick, what was the scene that hit your eyes arriving on the
Nothing.
Beach?
Just an empty road.
But the beach itself, was it crowded? Was there?
Oh, no, the beach had been pretty well cleared by then.
So you were coming across the dead and injured of
that's
the
right.
landing?
Yes. And although we didn't see many there, just where we landed. So I put my gear back on and said, right, come on, let's start the war again. And we start walking up. The first casualty I saw was a German. And I suddenly looked and I could only see there was the top half. It ended at his waist. And then over the other side was the rest of him, the bottom half, and there's no blood around. And then I realised, as I learnt later, it was the blast, and it just scythed it through him. And I mean, you then learnt, as time went on, what blast did. I mean, I've seen people naked, and then, you know, I remember walking one place and a shell landed, and it passed me, and the blast killed a fella about 20 feet behind me. So blast was a weird, strange phenomenon. And I think our first casualty was an accident. I remember coming up, and I saw this lad. And they were trying to attend to him, and blood was spouting like out of a fountain. And we were carrying on, you know, my platoon, and I learned afterwards he'd died. And I think he was the first casualty we had.